Station number 13143, Hubert Pond, Reel 1.
Whereabouts were you born, please?
I was born in Twickenham, Middlesex.
And I think that was in 23.
That's right.
Did you go to school in Twickenham?
Yes, I went to Thames Valley Grammar School.
What did your father do for a living?
My father worked in a I suppose you'd call it an oil and fuel shop in Brentford. An ironmongers, I suppose you'd call it.
How old were you when you left the grammar school?
16.
Just at the time the war broke out?
Yes, the war was on, and that gave me an ideal opportunity to get away from school, which I didn't particularly like.
What was your reaction to the news that we were at war with Germany?
That age didn't really mean much. It struck me that most of the boys older than me were very happy about it and the opportunity to get away from home and that sort of thing. But we didn't really think that too much. The excitement came a bit later when we had air raids and things.
So there was no sense of fear or apprehension?
No. We had no understanding of what war meant, really.
What were your steps with regard to the wars, your future?
Well, I first of all joined the air raid precautions outfit as a sort of messenger. And then I thought it would be more exciting to join the Home Guard, which were called the LDV in those days. And then as soon as I could, I volunteered for the boys' unit of the Royal Armoured Corps.
Which Home Guard units were you in?
Well, they would have been local Twickenham units.
What can you remember about being in the Home Guard?
I can remember drilling with the broomsticks because there were no guns available. I remember the discomfort of putting on rough, scratchy khaki for the first time. And of course, wearing khaki, we always hoped that the girls would pay more attention to us.
Which years do you think you were in the Home Guard?
It must have been, I joined the army 40, what, I can't remember that, I think it was 41. Must have been 1941.
That you were in the Home Guard?
Yes.
So was that after the immediate scare about invasion?
Yes, long after that, yes. The Home Guard really at that time were just doing drilling and marching and that sort of thing. There was no real wartime. Well, there was wartime stuff, but no real thought of war even then.
Did you eventually get guns to replace your broomsticks?
I can't remember getting guns while I was in the Home Guard. They used to give us lectures and they would have one gun to be able to show people what they could do with them, that sort of thing.
Do you think there would have been any use if the Germans had invaded?
No, I think we all treated it rather as a joke because we had broomsticks and forks and cudgels and this sort of thing. It was something. It was, I think, more designed to keep our morale high than anything else, I think.
Did you have any First World War veterans with you?
Oh yes, there were lots of most of the Home Guard were First World War veterans who probably tended to take it more seriously than we younger ones did.
Did you have any guard duties with them?
I can't remember doing any guard duties. I remember that members did go on guard duties at railway bridges and that sort of thing, but I can't remember myself ever doing one.
What about joining the army yourself? Can you tell me more about that, please?
Yes, well, after I left school, I was given a job in a paperworks as a clerk, and then eventually, as the people were called up into the army, they made me a travelling salesman, and my job was selling craft paper bags and rolls of wrapping paper. And I remember one thing, we sold perfumed toilet rolls. My job was selling these, and I wasn't very good at it, really, and I got rather bored with the job. And it must have been in 45, it's on the paper somewhere there, I can't remember the exact year, 41 or 42, when I joined the junior battalion of the Royal Armoured Corps at Bovington in Dorset.
According to your CV here that I've got in front of me, it was 41.
41, yeah.
Why the Royal Armoured Corps?
I'd just been on the verge of learning to drive a motor car. An assistant scoutmaster had a motor car, and he'd started teaching me this, and I became very keen on driving. So when I went into the recruiting station, because at that time I was still too early, too young, and the man said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I'd love to drive tanks." And he said, "Okay." He would put my name down for this. And it was the 52nd Royal Armoured Corps Young Soldiers Battalion. And I think after about 4 months I was called up because I was too young at the time to go in.
And then you went to Sandhurst?
No, we went down to Bovington in Dorset, which was the headquarters of the Royal Tank Regiment, and I think during the war the headquarters of the Royal Armoured Corps. That was in Dorset. It still is the Royal Tank Regiment's depot there. And it was somewhat of a shock joining the unit there. Most of the other chaps were, I think, came from very, very deprived families, and I'd had a very cosy home life. And I found the language and habits very, very different to what I'd been accustomed to at home. But after a few weeks, of course, it becomes second nature. If you're not careful, you find yourself joining in it.
How was it that you went to Sandhurst?
Well, I went to Sandhurst after a notice had been put up saying you are welcome to apply for commissions in the army. And a friend I'd made there said, "Why don't we go and join?" And I said, "Well, I didn't think I stood much chance as a grammar school boy and from a sort of non-army background." And he said, no, everybody can stand a chance these days." And when I went for my interview, the major who was doing the interviews was a chap in one of the cavalry regiments, and his office walls were covered in pre-war pictures of scouting activities. There were pictures of him with Baden Powell, and there were pictures of jamborees and camps. And I'd been a very, very keen Boy Scout. I'd become a King Scout, and I'd got my gold all-round cords. And as soon as I got the opportunity, we started talking about scouting. And we went on talking about scouting, which normally you don't meet many people in the army, not the regular army, who've been in the scouts, because at public schools they all went into the corps. So it was a very unusual thing. Anyway, obviously he thought I was worth something, and he recommended me. And then after that, of course, it went to Preoctu in Aldershot, and then after that to Sandhurst on a shortened wartime course.
How useful was the course at Sandhurst for you?
How useful was?
The Sandhurst course.
Very useful indeed. I found that my scouting stood me in very, very good stead for the army, because it meant I could cook, it meant I could keep dry, it meant I could find my way. And of course, I suppose I'd done a certain amount of leadership training in the scouts, so that must have helped. So it helped me a lot.
But was the Sandhurst course a good one?
Oh yes, it was a wartime course of, I think it was only 3 months in those days, but they still maintained their pre-war customs as far as possible. We were also supplied with civilian batmen who looked after our rooms, and it was a very civilized place to be. We had good dining in the dining rooms. We had good lecturers, good classrooms, and lots of sport and activities. It was a worthwhile course.
And then in 42 you were commissioned into the Royal Tank Regiment?
That's correct, yes. And I was commissioned into the 2nd Royal Tank Regiment, which was due to go to Persia, presumably to defend India from the possible advance by the Russians. And just prior to my posting there, I'd gone back to Bovington, the depot, waiting posting. I went up with a friend on motorcycles, obviously studying map reading and all this sort of thing. And I had a crash and very badly injured my left side. And as a result of that, I went to hospital and missed the draft to Persia, and they said it would be many, many months before I went. In the meantime, they gave me a job as tank compass instructor at the depot, which meant that for half an hour or 45 minutes a day, I gave a very boring lecture on a very boring subject, the tank compass, which isn't exactly a very complicated piece of machinery. And the rest of the day, I was left kicking my heels. And once again, I saw a notice on the board in the mess, I expect, saying volunteers are wanted for the parachute regiment. So I applied, and with one other young officer, we were told to go to Bulford for an interview.
What type of things did they want to know at the interview?
I think it was just more or less looking at us to see if we were suitable for joining a parachute regiment. The man in charge at that time was a man who eventually became Brigadier James Hill, who commanded the 3rd Brigade during the campaign in Northwest Europe. And he obviously agreed that we were suitable. I remember when I arrived with my with a red beret instead of a black beret. Subsequently, the adjutant, who'd never worn a beret in his life before, told me how I should wear a beret. I'd been wearing a beret the whole of my army service. It was one of those silly little things.
How did you get on with the training for the parachute regiment?
It was very tough, and it took me, I suppose, about a month to get really fit, because they really slung you straight into it. In those days, they had 50-mile walks in 24 hours in full equipment, 20-mile runs and walks in full equipment, and we always seemed to be doing everything at the double and going uphills, and they all seemed to be uphills. You never seemed to go downhill, and lots of rifle training, lots of night maneuvers. And, of course, coming in from another corps into a battalion that had originally been an Essex infantry battalion, the 10th Essex, were converted from infantry to become parachutists. So there were a lot of a bit of a difficult thing to get in with them to start with, but eventually it happened. And of course, until I took my parachute training, I wasn't really considered to be part of the battalion proper. So after I'd finished my course and went back to battalion, then I really felt that I belonged, and I think most of the chaps felt I belonged too.
What number para battalion was it?
This was the 9th battalion of the parachute regiment, a part of the 3rd Parachute Brigade, one of the three brigades in the 6th Airborne Division.
Were there many in your course who just had to drop out because they couldn't take the training?
No, I would think only about half a dozen, and they were mainly people who discovered they'd got weaknesses either in limbs, or one or two who decided that parachuting wasn't for them, but generally speaking, not too many. I remember the report from the parachute training school on the course I was on. It didn't specifically refer to the officers, although there may have been a second-hand thing there, but it said that most of the chaps were not very intelligent, but very enthusiastic and keen.
Do you think that was accurate?
Possibly. I don't think they were good, patriotic people, and I don't know from what point of view they were talking about intelligence. They had lots of natural intelligence. I don't know what the Air Force meant by lack of intelligence or not very intelligent. They may be referring to technical things or sort of thing which they weren't required to know. I certainly never found any lack of intelligence amongst the chaps I worked with in the parachute regiment.
What about parachuting itself? How did you get on with that?
I liked it very much. I found that the training was absolutely excellent. They got you to an instinctive situation where if you were walking along the road and somebody shouted go, you would start running or do something. It was all instinctive training. The moment an order was given, you had to do it immediately without thinking. And this is how they brought you into parachuting, where they got you to jump off a 40-foot ledge with a teeny-weeny little propeller, and, you know, thinking that propeller would not hold you, and that sort of thing. So you automatically did what the instructors shouted at you.
So it was a question of building up trust.
Really, trust and instinct. And it worked very well indeed. As a result, when we went up for our first balloon drop, we had no problems at all.
Whereabouts was the different aspects of training carried out?
Well, the battalion was based at Bulford and on the Salisbury Plain. Parachute training was at Manchester at Ringway. And there was further training in the Derbyshire Hills in a big manor, one of Elizabeth Shrewsbury's houses, Hardwick Hall, where we did a tremendous amount of training cross-country and up and down the hills there. So they were the three areas, Bulford, Derbyshire and Tatton Park, really, at Ringway.
Do you remember the name of the parachute instructor who dealt with you?
No, we didn't really know. What, we must have known their names at the time, but no, we didn't really.
Were there any serious accidents during the training?
One or two broken legs, bashed up arms, I suppose, one or two heads, but nothing really much. Most of the accidents really came in training, when people were stiff and rigid, and as they fell, they didn't sort of fall properly. By the time they got actually into a dropping parachute, they more or less knew what they got to do to break the fall when they landed.
Why should they have been stiff and rigid?
Well, they didn't altogether understand that as you came in from a parachute jump, you would be drifting one way or the other, and if you let your limbs hit the ground at an acute angle, the chances of breakages were much smaller than if you hit straight on, where you'd almost certainly break something. That was the thing, really, one had to learn. We were taught to keep your elbows in, your knees together, slightly bent, and that was the way you were taught to fall.
Were you told that you were training for some specific operation?
Not at that time, no. The first time we ever heard anything about a specific operation was in April 1944. And we knew that there must eventually be a landing in Europe because of the constant calls in the newspapers for a second front. But the very first time we knew that we had been chosen for a specific operation was April 44.
What were you told then, specifically?
We were told, well, my company, A Company, were called into the dining room, and the battalion commander, a man called Martin Lindsay, who eventually became MP for Solihull, said that he had been given a task of attacking a battery, and he could only do this if he could use a certain number of glider-borne troops, and he wanted 100 volunteers from A Company to say they would go in gliders in this operation. And of course, like all these things, everybody in the company stood up. Nobody would have had the guts to stay seated. And so that was that. And then we were left in the dark for a while. Of course, speculation was rife. I remember my platoon were convinced, or some wag decided, that they were going to be dressed as nuns and dropped somewhere in occupied France. Others thought they were going to kidnap high Nazi officials, but all of it was a load of old imagination and rubbish, but it kept them talking. And they kept us training all the time. And then the next thing that happened really was that they said, right, they chose 70 of us, as far as possible, all unmarried men, for this operation, which they called at that time a coup de main party. And the 70 of us who were chosen were sent off to Thruxton Airfield, which is on the Salisbury Plain. And there we were introduced to the gliders, and which were, the ones we used were hawsers, and the glider pilots and that sort of thing. The one from my platoon was piloted by a man called Staff Sergeant David Kerr, K-E-R-R, who won a Distinguished Flying Medal and was subsequently killed during the operations in Arnhem. Anyway, we were then given an orientation of the gliders, which we thought looked like matchboxes, and they're made of three ply, and we learned subsequently that they were mostly made by well-known furniture manufacturers and this sort of thing. They were sort of completely round fuselages with big wings, very low undercarriage, and they were painted sort of very dark with camouflage paint and things. Anyway, they said, okay, load up, and they told us how to get in and out of the glider, and we strapped ourselves into we sat sideways along the fuselage.
How were you supposed to get in and out of the glider?
Well, there's nothing very complicated about it. It was just a question of getting in and out as quickly as possible. It was just a door and some steps, and we just practiced getting in and out quickly. There was nothing very difficult about it. The interesting thing we found was that being taken up into the air by that time, I think they were using Stirling bombers, which were the biggest four-engine bombers at the time. And I suppose the bomber would be located on the runway about a couple of hundred feet in front of us. We were sitting in the glider. And then a nylon rope was zigzagged between the tug plane and ourselves. And it was the tug plane, the Stirling, would run up its four engines to its greatest pitch and let go very rapidly, and it would go down the runway, and the nylon hawser, zigzagging, would gradually stretch. It was a very, very elastic, this nylon thing, so that actually when it was taut, the pulling us to start wasn't really, we expected a big snatch at us, but it wasn't. It was really quite a gentle tug, and away we went. And the glider pilot's first job at that stage was to get his glider, above the tug plane to make it easier for the plane to climb, because if he was underneath, it would be a drag on the plane. So he got up to what they call the high toe position as quickly as possible. And when they got to the cruising height or whatever it is they wanted, there was a telephone cable along that nylon hawser, and the pilot would then tell the glider pilot what to do and that sort of thing. So that was very interesting from our point of view. And then eventually they cast us off, which meant our glider pilot pulled a lever and the hawser dropped away, and it seemed almost as if the glider came to a dead stop in the air, because the forward momentum was decreased very rapidly. And then the pilot took the glider back to the airfield, and he came down in a series of quite steep spirals, because gliders do tend to come down very steeply. And when he got to near the airport, we saw for the first time that circles had been whitewashed onto the grass, and what the pilot had to do was to land the glider as near close to the center of this ring as he possibly could, which meant he went down at a steep angle, then pulled up, put full flaps on them, very big flaps, and also ejected an arrestor parachute from the tail. And they really became quite good at this operation of getting the glider into the middle of the circle.
What were the main difficulties as far as you were concerned?
We didn't really. I think we'd gone into this glider business not having a very good opinion of glider-borne troops. We thought it was easy enough to sit on a glider and just be taken into battle, where we had to jump out of aeroplanes and come down by parachute. We subsequently discovered that it's just as dangerous going in by glider as any other way into battle. The object of landing in these rings was that we discovered that the battery we were going to attack, which we still didn't know where it was, which country or anything at all, there were casements in the battery, and the theory was that the three gliders, there were going to be three of us in this attack, would land between four casements, so there were three gaps between the casements, and the theory was that the glider would land in the manner which I already described, and in addition to the flaps, the brakes, and the arrestor parachute, the wings of the glider would break off on the casements, bringing the glider to a complete halt. So the idea was, in between each of the gun casements, there would be three gliders full of armed men.
What do you remember happening next in the training?
We moved to a village called Inkpen in Berkshire, where the engineers, and using aerial photographs, had discovered a piece of ground which was pretty well identical to the area in which the battery was located in Normandy, which, of course, we didn't know at that time. And what they did very quickly was to carve the countryside up and turn it into what the battery was like. The casemates were built of scaffolding and netting and all that sort of thing. They actually dug the anti-tank ditches, they erected the wire, they even put up signs saying Achtung Minen, and they had all the equipment. They put up the barbed wire all around the thing, and it really did look like a real battery, really. And we rehearsed all the things we were supposed to do on this ground. Of course, we couldn't use real gliders because they were in short supply, and we couldn't do parachute jumps because, again, they were getting ready for the second front. So it was all done on ground. But I remember it was rather an eerie feeling. It was presumed that we had landed from our gliders, and we then stood inside the perimeter of this mock-up battery, knowing full well that the rest of our battalion were approaching the wire, and we wonder what's going to happen when they all start firing their mortar bombs and their guns and things. What's going to happen to us? In the event, of course, we were supposed to fire a red light, and then all firing would stop. And in this night rehearsal, they actually used Bangalore torpedoes to blow the wire, and they used blank ammunition and this sort of thing. And at the correct sign, we rushed off to the dummy guns, and we pretended we'd blown these guns, and there was no need for the rest of the battalion to come in and all that sort of thing. So that I think they trained us to cover every capability and every possibility, and the training was absolutely first class.